were once in the Atlantic and today live only in the Pacific, how did they ever cross ocean basins? Changes in sea level would have provided few portals across oceans. Even at times of sea level highs, the terrain of Panama is still too high to cross. A trip around Cape Horn, off South America, would require dispersal equivalent to the circumference of the entire planet, over 26,000 miles. That distance is perhaps not outside the realm of possibility for a species of whale that migrates half that far on an annual basis. But there is a much better reason to suspect that the answer lies in the Northwest Passage. It's not just because the Canadian Arctic would have afforded an open passage during warm times and high sea level. Rather, it's because gray whales are already probably using the Northwest Passage to get back into the Atlantic right now. I remember seeing the first reports of living gray whales outside the Pacific surface on an internet message board. A few years ago, researchers in Israel photographed a whale that they had never seen before. The only identification they could hazard was gray whale, a pinched heart-shaped tail fluke, mottled gray body coloring, and especially a knuckled tail stalk. This same individual whale, identified by the white splotches on its tail fluke, then turned up off the coast of Spain several months later. And then came similar reports, with photographs, of another gray whale spotted off the coast of Namibia, well south of the equator. Researchers concluded that the most likely pathway for these errant gray whales was through the Northwest Passage, probably during a nearly ice-free summer. The straight-line distance of this migration from Baja to Israel via the Arctic adds up to nearly 24,000 miles, which would be an astonishing figure for a single lost whale. But we know that this figure is about the same as the distance from Baja to Namibia. At the moment, these two examples might just be anecdotes, or harbingers of system-wide shifts in the Arctic. The ongoing and future changes to the Arctic essentially mean a large-scale transition of its ocean from an ice-covered one to an open or pelagic one. In other words, the Arctic Ocean will start to look more like oceans at other latitudes, but with polar seasonal settings, including long summer daylight hours. The sunlight, unimpeded by ice, will boost trophic productivity, increasing the prey resources on the seafloor and in the water column, which is ideal habitat for gray whales, among other species. Over the course of a few whale generations, movement through this passage may be more than mere dispersal to a newly available habitat. It might become a future migration route for whale species that already migrate thousands of miles, such as humpback, sei, minke, and even right whales. If the Northwest Passage was indeed their dispersal route, the projected ice-free summers in a 21st century Arctic bode well for more Atlantic invaders. The future of gray whales may be closer than we think. After stopping for ice cream, we pulled up to the lighthouse parking lot, a few minutes' drive away from Whalebone Junction. An avalanche of toys, books, and foodstuff spilled out of the car as the kids climbed out and made a beeline for the lighthouse. A square, two-story house that formed the keeper's quarters stood directly in front of the lighthouse, a 150-foot-tall brick building built in 1872, striped in black and white. I like lighthouses, their picturesque seaside settings, the views they offer, their history. Lighthouses were critical pieces of coastal infrastructure and national security in the 19th century. In 1883, one of my predecessors at the Smithsonian, Frederick William True, proposed that lighthouse keepers record whale strandings. It would take nearly 100 years for NOAA to establish the first stranding networks, which now capture the what, when, and where of any whale stranding reported in the United States. Back down on the ground, our children ran on the brick path from the lighthouse to the old lightkeeper's house nearby. My son outpaced his sister in the spontaneous race, opening a gap. My wife, walking close alongside me, grabbed my hand and squeezed my fingers. Lighthouse keeping is no more, replaced by automation. car trips to this place also might soon be a thing of the past, depending on how fast sea levels rise. Lighthouses along the coast have already been moved against the receding shorelines. I wondered how many more times lighthouses would be moved again, and what my own children might witness. Trying to understand the transformations that happened in the planet's past captivates me as a scientist. As a parent, I wondered how much I could do to prepare my children for their future. The next day, we sat on a beach at Kill Devil Hills, just north of Whalebone Junction. The kids dug endlessly in the surf, poked sodden flotsam, and occasionally faked a run toward the waves. I found myself distracted, staring at the fine line of the horizon between slate-green water and azure sky. Gray whale bones at the Smithsonian, in the collections that I oversee, were collected just south and north along this same stretch of coastline, only miles away in Nag's Head and Kerala. The bones are so worn and roughed up that they can hardly be called beautiful, but they demarcate in a real way past worlds that perhaps no one saw. Gray whales were probably critical members of ancient Atlantic food webs, as much as they are in the Pacific today. How far and where did Atlantic gray whales migrate? They survived many episodes of glacial ice sheets and sea level drops that changed their habitat. How and why did they disappear from the Atlantic? Did they leave any genetic traces in today's Pacific gray whales? All of these questions fundamentally stem from a historical perspective on whales that is contiguous with what we see today, not just a pale, creased vignette of the past. Past whale worlds aren't really dead. They're not even past, to paraphrase Faulkner. Thinking about those bones and those questions made me think that on a fall day in a few decades, it might not seem strange to see gray whales spy hopping along the Atlantic coastline once again. Maybe they'll do so alongside North Atlantic right whales, which narrowly averted extinction, and ever-present bottlenose dolphins. I imagine these gray whales, newly returned to the Atlantic, carrying biologging tags and accompanied by drones, technologies created as an extension of our senses to help us spy more effectively on their hidden lives. And maybe the view will be from a boat, not a sandhill, if we can't figure out how to stop the rise of the seas should the great glacial ice far north and south all melt. Places like the Outer Banks would slip under the waves, returning any still undiscovered whale bones of past gray whales back to the water. I don't doubt that there will still be scientists eager to dive after them or chase after the whales navigating the seas of a new world. Epilogue. The warm water of the Chesapeake Bay lapped over my feet as I walked behind my son, who scoured pebbles in the surf. I kept an eye on him as my colleague Dave Bohaska walked beside me. I knew that we stood a good chance of finding a few fossil shark teeth and some nice shells on this western side of the bay. The tall Calvert Cliffs, which line this part of the Chesapeake's shoreline in Maryland, have produced hundreds of thousands of Miocene-age fossils, including many skulls and skeletons of fossil whales. All of my predecessors at the Smithsonian, people like Frederick True and Remington Kellogg, either knew about or collected fossil marine mammals here. It was supposed to be a leisurely Sunday, and we held no high hopes for a significant find. I hadn't brought any tools, and I mainly wanted to unplug and spend time outside with my son. Maybe fossils would inspire him, as they did me, but I wasn't going to push it. Dave lives nearby, in the community of Scientists Cliffs, and he was happy to take us on a neighborhood walk. If nothing else, the community's name alone is sufficiently auspicious for casual fossil finding. Abruptly, my son paused next to a block of sediment that had slid down to the beach. "Dad, what's this?" he called. I walked up and knelt down for a closer look. Dave and I are both familiar enough with these kinds of anatomical riddles to immediately recognize that it was the snout of a whale. The rest of the skull was either still trapped high in the cliff face from which this block had tumbled or lost to the bay. On closer inspection, the right and left snout bones were strongly skewed, near where the face housed a biosonar apparatus. I thought that it probably belonged to Erictrocetus, a fossil sperm whale that Kellogg worked on extensively, especially from these rocks. "Well, gee," Dave said, smiling. "Anders," I said proudly, "you just found a fossil whale." My son, then 4 years old, wasn't quite sure what to make of the situation. I stood up and exhaled. "Damn it," I said softly. Deciding against bringing excavation gear guarantees that you'll need it. No hammer, no plaster, no pickaxe. Dave and I traded glances. "It's at tide level, fair game for collecting," Dave remarked, implying that we were clear, legally, to do so for the Smithsonian. I reached into my day pack and pulled out a small knife. Dave had one, too. We were losing daylight and didn't have time to hike back to Dave's house for more tools. The tide was coming in. Who knew if the snout would still be there the next day? I looked at our pocket knives and considered the muddy, waterlogged sediment. "All right, let's do it," I said, and we started digging. Sometimes finds of happenstance are curiosities. Sometimes they are important scientific discoveries and should be collected. I thought the snout was probably the latter, well worth the trouble. Sperm whales have one of the deepest evolutionary histories of any living group of whales, stretching from the iconic sperm whale of Moby Dick back to fossils from the Oligocene, more than 23 million years ago. While sperm whales in the fossil record may differ in details of tooth size and subtle sutures of the skull, they all share a bowl-like concavity on their face, housing the junk and case, special terms for their biosonar organs, owing to 19th century whalers who sought their fine and lucrative oil. Fossil sperm whales can be found all around the world, represented mainly by large, handsome teeth, sometimes the weight and size of a wine bottle. We'd found them at Cerro Baena. Today's sperm whales' polished teeth are the stuff of scrimshaw and lore, ivory anvils of 10,000 squid meals. We scraped away sediment to guess the dimensions, in keeping with an Erictrocetus snout. We would need to carry it up several staircases to where we'd parked. The snout had no teeth with it, unfortunately, just deep grooves on the palate where they once were held in place by ligaments. Still, it was more than I had ever found at the cliffs. I took off my t-shirt to make a sling for the block. As we trenched out the snout, I occasionally shot a glance at my son, who chucked handfuls of rock into the tide, lacking anything more substantive to do. I thought about how at one point, about 15 million years ago, this snout belonged to a living, breathing sperm whale. This long-extinct individual whale had a life history, a diet, and it belonged to a vanished ecosystem. I wondered about the owner of this snout and thought about questions that paleontologists would have trouble answering. Was it a mother? Was it part of a society with culture? Would this Miocene whale have been able to communicate with its descendants alive now? Did it sleep vertically in a floating forest of leviathans just below the surface, the way sperm whales sometimes do today? We individuate whales as a way to know them, to chip away at their mystery, whether it's a fragment of skull, the unique squiggle of an acoustic click's waveform, or a distinctive modeling on a tail fluke. We give individual whales familiar names or alphanumerics to differentiate them from their kin, as if that somehow circumscribes their enigma, easing our inquiry into their history and lives. Individual whales matter because they sometimes carry the superlatives that scientists bestow. Individuals are, after all, tied to the records of the largest, the deepest, the first, and sometimes the last. But this is how science happens. Collect these individuals together under a specific question or a line of inquiry, and you can build a broader picture that begins to illuminate the inaccessibility of whales. I interrogate individuals when I pick up a skull or a bone and ask, "Who are you?" That's my starting point for discovery. And I know that chain of questioning is not unique to me. It's the same question asked of the plug of tissue stuck in a biopsy dart, or through the observation panel of an aquarium, gazing at a captive dolphin. Who are they? That's ultimately what we want to know about whales. Later that evening, my son in bed, I headed to the National Museum of Natural History in downtown Washington, D.C., to haul the block containing the snout to my laboratory. I rolled a cart over to my parked car in the dark and unloaded the skull bones, still wrapped in a soaked T-shirt. Earlier that day, the fossil had been an anonymous hunk of bone stuck in marl. Now it would be prepared, cleaned, measured, studied, and preserved for generations to come. It would receive its own catalog number, USNM 559329. With my son recorded in the database as its collector. It would join the ranks of thousands of other fossil specimens like it at the Smithsonian, each one with a story to tell. Those stories are discoveries waiting to be made, some mundane, others that could rewrite textbooks. And that's what makes science so much fun. Teasing out the facts from the unknown depends on asking the right question. The answer might tell you a lot about the past, present, and future of whales. Acknowledgements. I had been thinking about writing this book for many years. It started with vignettes that I had collected while doing science all around the world. The sketches and stories gelled over the course of swaying subway commutes, staring out airplane windows, and quiet moments in the field, aboard ships, at rock outcrops, and along windswept shores. These snapshots represent many threads from investigating the past and present lives of whales, something that makes the stories in this book about the people who contribute to science as much as it is about whales. Foremost, I'm especially grateful for the kindness and hospitality of colleagues in Santiago, Caldera, Lima, Panama City, San Diego, Los Angeles, Bakersfield, Pacific Grove, Santa Cruz, Berkeley, Newport, Seattle, Victoria, Vancouver, Sitka, Oshoro, Melbourne, Wellington, Dunedin, Folly Beach, Scientist Cliffs, and Reykjavik. I'm profoundly thankful for the trust and camaraderie of Bridget Matsey, who along with Esmond Harmsworth saw the bigger picture in the first fragments of undigested text. This book would have stayed in vignette form if it weren't for Emily Wunderlich's dedication and sharp editorial pen. I'm so grateful for her ability to spot a narrative from rough shards of half stories and hear the precise meaning of an idea obscured by poor form, annoyance, or exhaustion. Shannon O'Neill was indispensable as a wordsmith, whisperer, and therapist. In an early stage, Melanie Tortoroli's exhortations and guidance set me on the right course. I knew that this book found the right home with all the staff at Viking. I was constantly reassured by their professionalism and attentive care, especially from Hillary Roberts and Cassandra Garuzzo. I'm also grateful for the persistence and support from key members of the Smithsonian side of this book, including Carol LeBlanc, Bridget Ferraro, Sue Perez Jackson, Carolyn Gleason, and Aaron Starn. Alex Borsma crafted every illustration in this book. Each one is an original piece made in linocut or scratchboard, specific to the stories in this book and generated out of a common way of looking at the world. Alex was uniquely suited for the task, not merely as an artist and a scientist, and she is definitely both, but also because of her own first-hand knowledge of all things cetacean, by pneumatic chisel, scalpel blade, and tagging pole. Thank you for coming along on the journey. From the outset, there were people who intuitively understood why I would write a book like this one. You should be so lucky to have the kind of support that I received from Ari Friedlander, Jeremy Goldbogen, Carolina Gutstein, Chris Helgen, Katie Cooker, Jean Kwan, Holly Little, Megan McKenna, Jessica Meir, Aaron O'Day, Jim Parham, Chris Perda, Aviva Rosenthal, Carolyn Stromberg, Leslie Thorne, Jan Vendetti, Steve Weyer, and Greg Wilson. You each restore meaning to the most commodified word of our time, friend. You also want your book to be read, or at least be readable. I'm grateful for the encouragement and thoughtful comments at various stages from Lauren Applebaum, Kay Behrensmeyer, Matt Carano, Daniel Epstein, Doug Irwin, Molly Fannin, Ari Friedlander, Jeremy Goldbogen, Gene Hunt, Sarah Hurt, Randy Ermus, Dave Lindberg, Kevin Padian, Jim Parham, Aviva Rosenthal, and Bob Shadwick. There's also nothing like the unvarnished truth from family. Sue Hunter, Tom Hunter, Mitch Hunter, Ben Pyenson, Catherine Pyenson, and Lewis Pyenson read through many drafts and never hesitated to tell me where I went wrong. In the early stages, Neil Shubin, Scott Sampson, Tim Flannery, Ed Yong, and Sean B. Carroll offered requisite book writing advice. Passages in this book about the vaquita also first appeared in an article for Smithsonian Magazine in 2017. At key moments, I benefited from the support of Wayne Clough, Sarah Goforth, Nancy Knowlton, John Kress, Hilary Rosner, Sabrina Schultz, and Lydia Pine. I especially want to thank Jan and John Straley in Sitka and John and Terry Miller in San Pedro. Our conversations over a meal were important to me in ways that they didn't know. I thank all of the dedicated staff who contribute to the many-sided mission of the Smithsonian Institution, which is a constellation of museums, research centers, and field stations, among other entities. I would like to especially highlight the support that I've received for my own research program from the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, the Office of International Relations, Smithsonian Libraries, including all the divisional libraries, Smithsonian Enterprises, the Office of General Counsel, the Office of Public Affairs, and the Digitization Program Office. Closer to my own world, I thank the offices of the Director, Communications, Development, the Associate Director of Science at the National Museum of Natural History, and the terrific staff in my own Department of Paleobiology. Aside from those mentioned in the book, I leaned on the expertise of many people in the process of writing this book. I thank them for their time and hold them blameless for my own mistakes. Renee Albertson, Lars Bader, Gunnar Bergman, Trevor Branch, Paul Brody, Bob Brownell, Graham Burnett, Ellen Chenoweth, Frederick Christensen, Phil Clapham, Eric Fitzgerald, Ewan Fordyce, Shane Jarrow, Stephen Godfrey, Dali Haldorsson, Yulia Ivaschenko, Jen Jackson, Dave Johnston, Bob Jones, Igor Krupnik, Kristen Lader, Haldor Larusson, Jacobus LaRue, Christian Lofson, Lori Marino, Chris Marshall, Rocky McGowan, Jim Mead, Dick Norris, Aaron O'Day, Droplog Olofstotter, Daniel Palacios, Charlie Potter, Stephen Raverty, David Rubilar Rogers, Angie Sremba, Gabor Zathmary, Hans Tewison, Kirsten Thompson, Gisli Vikingsen, Wayne Vogel, and Alex Worth. While writing this book, I also leaned heavily on all of the members, past and present, in my research group. I owe a debt of thanks to Carlos Burrito, Matt Leslie, Ali Fleming, Annie Valenzuela Toro, Janelle Larson, Jorge Velazuarbe, Free Engel, Holly Little, Neil Kelly, Maya Yamato, Matt McCurry, Dave Bohaska, and Carrie Carter. I wrote a large portion of this book during a winter in Alaska as a visiting scientist at the Sitka Sound Science Center through their Scientist in Residence Fellowship Program. I warmly thank Lisa Bush, Tori O'Connell, Lauren Bell, Dane McFadden, the Straleys, and Davey Lubbin for all their hospitality. I am, beyond all else, indebted to my wife, Emily Hunter Pyonson, who kept my world together during the prolonged hellfire of book writing, reading countless drafts, clarifying ideas with incisive thought, and reminding me about the big picture. I hope that our children might read this book one day to understand a bit more about why their father cares about bones, skeletons, and mysteries pulled from the sea. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Spying on Whales, the past, present, and future of Earth's most awesome creatures. This program was directed by David Rapkin. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Text, copyright 2018 by the Smithsonian Institution. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.